to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Coming up in the show, we'll have an interview with Ross Wilburn, a candidate for governor in the Democratic Party. This is the seventh in a series of interviews of gubernatorial candidates that Local Talk has been airing over the past 2 weeks, and you can find the other interviews on the KHOI website. Also on today's show, we'll learn about the NASA mission called InSight, which was recently launched on its way to Mars. We'll hear from two people who were at the launch, one of whom worked on the NASA project for the past 5 years. And in the last part of the show, we'll speak with Lojean Peterson, the manager of the Main Street Farmers Market here in Ames. The weather was lovely on Saturday. It was a great day to be outside, whether you were at the farmers market, working in your yard, or just walking around. Then we got a bit of needed rain late on Saturday and into Sunday, and it looks like that trend will continue this week. Today will be cloudy with showers and a high of around 70 degrees. Tuesday through Friday will be warmer in the high 70s and 80s and low 80s. But there is a chance of showers every day. So that's good for folks who've planted their gardens and farmers whose crops are in the field. And the good news is that next Saturday and Sunday is predicted to be sunny and around 80 degrees. So if that holds, it looks like it will be a very nice Memorial Day weekend. And now here is the rundown of news from across Iowa and Iowa in the national news. On Friday, the farm bill was defeated in the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. Conservative House Republicans voted against it in protest when Paul Ryan refused to schedule an immediate vote on a restrictive immigration bill. Republican moderates also refused to support it, trying to force votes on legislation to protect from deportation undocumented immigrants brought to the country as children. The bill did not have support of Democrats in the House either, because it included a work requirement for food stamp recipients, including those in their 50s or for parents of school-aged children. Congressman Dave Lubsack, a Democrat from Iowa City, was the first member of Iowa's delegation in the House to release a written statement after the vote. He stated, quote, "House Republicans today showed that they care more about being partisan than passing a farm bill to support Iowa farmers and rural communities. In what has historically been done in a bipartisan manner with a rural-urban coalition, this farm bill has devolved into a partisan food fight," end quote. Iowa Representative Steve King, who voted in favor of the bill, responded to the failure of the farm bill by saying, quote, "It went down because no Democrat supports work. It went down because some Republicans wanted to leverage the farm bill in order to get a bill out on the floor to vote on that has within it two components of amnesty, and I oppose amnesty because it destroys the rule of law," end quote. The defeated bill also included an amendment proposed by Representative Steve King to ban state and local governments from imposing standards on other states' agricultural products. This would have overridden bans in California and several other states on the sale of eggs from hens raised in battery cages. Producers in Iowa and other states claimed that this unfairly burdened them, since California is one of the largest markets for eggs. Some attorneys general claim the California ban violates the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Animal welfare advocates felt the King Amendment undermined important welfare standards for chickens and other farm animals. And Harvard's Animal Law and Policy Program argued that the measure was phrased so broadly it could prevent states from enforcing laws on everything from invasive pests to narcotics. Senator Chuck Grassley urged House Republicans to come up with a better farm bill. In a tweet, he advocated for preventing federal farm subsidies for people who are not farmers and have merely invested in farmland. The current farm bill expires on September 30th. On Tuesday, May 15th, Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa filed a lawsuit challenging the new Iowa law banning most abortions. During an early afternoon news conference in Des Moines, Rita Bettis, the legal director for the ACLU of Iowa, said the law would ban abortions as soon as any cardiac activity is detected in an embryo, and that typically happens at around 6 weeks in pregnancy. This is before many women even know they're pregnant. Bettis continued, quite plainly, with this new law, Iowa politicians have tried to ban virtually all abortions in the state of Iowa, end quote. The lawsuit's ultimate aim is to get Iowa's Supreme Court to rule the law unconstitutional. The groups are seeking a court order to prevent the law from taking effect on July 1st. Iowa Attorney General Miller wrote a letter to the state legislature on Tuesday saying he will not represent the state of Iowa in the lawsuit, explaining that he could not zealously assert the state's position because of his core belief that the statute, if upheld, would undermine rights and protections for women. Governor Reynolds announced that a Chicago law firm called the Thomas More Society will provide the legal defense for the state's new abortion restriction at no cost to the taxpayers. Also on Tuesday, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley said he'll call for Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt's resignation if Pruitt doesn't work to fulfill federal ethanol mandates. Grassley asserted that President Trump, with whom he had recently met on the issue of ethanol, is committed to upholding the mandate that 15 billion gallons of ethanol be mixed into the nation's fuel supply. But Pruitt has been allowing refineries to evade some of that commitment by issuing waivers. Grassley says that has reduced ethanol content to 13.8 billion gallons nationwide. Grassley commented, quote, "I'm sick and tired of messing around with this anymore. Trump was elected with an agenda. Pruitt was not elected, and it's Pruitt's job to carry out the Trump agenda." And that's a roundup of Iowa news and Iowa in the national news. Iowa's statewide primary election will take place on June 5th. And KHOI has been bringing you in-depth conversations with each of the candidates vying to unseat Governor Kim Reynolds. In today's segment, KHOI correspondent Cal Halliburton sat down with Democratic candidate Ross Wilburn.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Mr. Ross Wilburn. Mr. Wilburn's running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Mr. Wilburn grew up in Davenport, Iowa, where he graduated from Davenport Central High School. He holds a bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Iowa School of Social Work. He worked for 6 years as Director of Equity for the Iowa City Community School District, 8 years as Executive Director of the Crisis Center of Johnson County, and 9 years as Program Coordinator for United Action for Youth in Johnson County. He also was an instructor at the University of Iowa. Wilburn served 12 years on the City Council in Iowa City and 2 years as mayor. He now lives in Ames and is the Diversity Officer and Associate Program Director of Community and Economic Development for Iowa State University Extension and Outreach. He's a veteran of the Iowa Army National Guard. Ross, could you tell our listeners something about yourself that they'll not find on your website or with a search engine?
Very good. First, let me say you did your homework. That was probably the most thorough introduction I've heard since I've been on the campaign trail. A couple things that they wouldn't know about me. These are more personal things. One is that I play the clarinet. I'm a musician. So I've been playing the clarinet since about 1974, 73, and did the Allstate Music thing. So the first times I was in Ames, Iowa was for the Allstate Music Festival. I was a three-year Allstater. And so I also play guitar, a little bit of guitar. But I think some folks will know that I'm a pretty avid cyclist. I really enjoy riding.
Will you be participating in RAGBRAI then?
You know, I'm taking vacation from May 21st through the primary. So I think I'll have some vacation time left. I'm going to be campaigning full time so I can get out there and kind of try and close the deal here for the primary election. But if I at a minimum, I will be able to ride into Ames and ride into Iowa City. But I'm hoping to get out there for the whole week. It's a great way to talk to Iowans and people from around the world. That's what I love about it.
As you talk to people around the state, what are their most frequent concerns?
I have been traveling the state, and all of us have, but I have learned from being in the rural areas of Iowa that there's a pretty big concern consistent with what I hear from folks in the urban areas about mental health issues. Closing down the mental health centers without a plan for supporting those individuals in their communities, that's not what neighbors do to neighbors, and we want to create opportunities, and that's not being Iowa. Our campaign theme is let's be Iowa. Let's put people into office that are going to make policy that will benefit all Iowans. So concern about not having a comprehensive mental health care system, especially related to children here in the state, not having the ability to have a emergency psychological assessment, people having to go to other states to have that done. You just can't have that. And my experience as a former social worker, as well as the director of the Crisis Center of Johnson County and the suicide hotlines there, just shows me and reinforces for me that mental health care is a critical issue here for Iowa.
Were there any other issues you encountered?
Absolutely. In terms of the environment and both with clean air and clean water, concern across the board about being able to drink clean water, to make sure that our waterways are available for people to go swimming without fear of E. coli. And so people wanted to see some more responsibility in terms of monitoring the runoff that happens into our waterways, people wanting to see the Department of Natural Resources staffed at a level that they can enforce the master matrix, which needs to be done in terms of some of the larger hawk confinement areas, as well as making sure that we continue to enhance our strength in terms of environmental energy, clean energy. We're number two in the nation, I believe, still in wind. But, you know, if we're going to give a tax credit, let's pump up the solar. You know, the saying goes, the solution rises every day. And, those are some things that both in terms of getting ourselves to be prepared, resilient in terms of climate change. Climate change is real. And I believe the science, and a lot of Iowans do believe in science, and wanted to see not only an opportunity for jobs, but to be sustainable, to leave this state and this world there for the next generation. And I think the other thing, and the, kind of the third tier of why I'm running, people concerned about us not being a welcoming and inclusive state. Governor Ray welcomed folks here in the 1970s from Southeast Asia, fleeing persecution, and now their children, their grandchildren are a part of the fabric of Iowa. They're working jobs. They are our neighbors. And we've got people over the years who've been coming here from various African countries, various Latin American countries, all over the world. And they may or may not have citizenship status, but they are contributing. They are carpenters. Some of them are teachers. Some of them are working in agriculture. And we need to get away from this sense of fear that whatever our lot in life and problems are, it's not them, it's not those people. That, you know, that's some of the quotes that you hear coming from President 45. But we need to make sure that regardless of citizenship status, regardless of someone's sexual orientation or gender identity, whether you're from urban or rural Iowa, that there are opportunities here. Diversity and inclusion is important, but it's about creating that sense of opportunity and belonging as part of Iowa.
Well, let's assume you're elected. Mm-hmm. Are there some specific things that you think you can do to alleviate those situations that you just mentioned?
Well, let me start with the budget. And, you know, we need to review and roll back some of the corporate tax breaks, another couple billion in tax breaks have been given here. And that's, a hole in the budget is an understatement in terms of the issues that we talked about in terms of the environment and jobs and education, being able to fund education. I mean, that all is going to require money. So in order to reprioritize the budget, we need to look at the revenue and the expenditure side in terms of priorities. As a former mayor and city council member in Iowa City, we maintained a AAA bond rating, which is the highest that Moody's can give to a city. What that meant was that we were thorough in planning city services, responsible with the tax dollar. We held public hearings and let the public know, here's our plans for the next 3 to 5 years in terms of our immediate budget and our capital budget, things that funds like roads and bridges and parks. But we also invested in our people. So it wasn't just about making sure that there were fire services and the trash and recycling were picked up, but we provided voluntarily as a city funding for agencies that support services like youth and shelter services here in Ames. We also funded some of our senior services and support agencies that provided support for survivors of domestic violence. And so just that's – I will draw upon that experience to help us relook at some of the tax incentives, to putting education as a priority, to trying to establish mental health care here in the state. You know, I also like to look at is there an action we can take that will address two or three different critical areas. We know that we have a shortage of mental health care providers here in the state. We know that there's concern about tuition. One of the things that some states have tried is provide a incentive for students in college, whether it's 2-year, 4-year degree or certificate. If they make a commitment to stay in their state for a couple years, then the state will pick up after other forms of financial aid. So why don't we do that for students who might be interested in going into mental health care? That if once you get your degree, you'll stay in the state of Iowa, helping fulfill that need going forward so that Iowans are having good mental health assessment, good mental health care, and able to contribute to the state. So that's mm-hmm. that's one area, but again, it cuts across a couple different areas.
You mentioned water quality.
Yes.
And I characterize some of our situation as the fact that we have 8,000 pools of poo spread all over, especially right. north central Iowa. And that, of course, leaks into our groundwater and is leaking into our aquifers.
Yes.
What would you do about that?
We need to redo the master matrix, which helps determine where the placement of some of those the larger hog confinement facilities. That's part of this big equation, but a major part, just like you talked, the fields of poo. We need to staff the Department of Natural Resources, so part of its budget, staff them at a level that they can enforce the new matrix once it's done, and give the director to the Department of Natural Resources that you will enforce that. So that's part of what we can do. I think we can hold that as a piece of leverage. That's something if we do something like put some type of moratorium on there, that would likely end up in some type of litigation. But let's start by, staffing DNR. Let's start by redoing the master matrix. Let's do enforcement. And then if we end up in court with it and needing to do some type of moratorium, that would be something to look at. But again, these are some of those larger hog confinements. Some of the owners are out of state. They're not some of the smaller local farmers that we're talking about that are contributing to this. I think the other thing that we can do is not ignore monitoring water, that's our waterways. I mean, that was something that was done, don't fund it. And so we'll ignore the issue. And Iowans, we face the issues and problems that we have. And that's part of being Iowa too, is let's take a serious look at the issues. Let's try and put policy. And if it involves funding, then fund areas that are going to keep the environment clean, that are going to provide those good jobs and opportunity for us. Those are a couple things, but, funding the Leopold Center, critical services that are provided in terms of sustainable agriculture, cover crops, and those types of things. Again, it's putting the things in place that are going to benefit the state of Iowa.
Well, one of the things that's been pushed by some candidates lately is minimum wage and raising that minimum wage. Do you have a thought about that?
I do. Minimum wage should have been raised a long time ago. And the figure that
a lot of Democrats are putting forward is $15 an hour, and that's something that I do support. At a minimum, we need to have a legislature that's willing to do that. And so we need to get folks elected to office, and I'm putting forth the Democrats are willing to do that as something that we've been saying that we will do. If we don't get control of the House to do that, it's not something the governor can do alone. But maybe if it's a split legislature, trying to use the budget process to help negotiate to try and get at least returning the right to counties and cities to at the local level to set the minimum wage, which was taken away. There were a few counties that had done that, but the legislature, when they did when they were doing some of their Chapter 20 work and then looking at the minimum wage, they took that right away. So that's something I would work to try and reinstill. I think the state needs to have a floor for a minimum wage. That's why I'm saying if we can at least return the right back to counties, then try and work and see if we can get some Republicans willing to at least lift the state minimum wage so that it's a floor. And if some cities, counties want to go up from that, then they'll work with their citizens in their county to make that determination locally.
One of the difficulties I think we're having with working with politics in Iowa is the huge amount of money that's coming into this state from out of state.
Right.
And you know, some folks talk about restricting that. Do you have any thought about that?
In terms of like campaign contribution, is that what you're
– Well, just... you know, whatever you might consider. I don't know if you've considered that.
Mm-hmm. Well, as it relates to influencing elections, mm-hmm. then, you know, we need to get folks elected to Washington, D.C., representing us, our representatives and our senator. But as a governor, I would try and press for that national campaign finance reform.
Well, some states do limit campaign contributions to mm-hmm. state elections.
That's true.
Whereas we do not.
Yeah,
now.
That's right. And I would certainly take a look at you know, putting some campaign finance reform, what we're able to do here locally in terms of the like you're saying, you know, for governor, it's unlimited.
It's our pleasure today to have been talking with Ross Wilburn. Mr. Wilburn is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Thank you very much, Ross, for being with us.
Great to be here. Pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in today.
That was the seventh of a series of interviews done by KHOI reporter Cal Halliburton with candidates for governor. The eighth and final interview will be aired on Wednesday on Local Talk. If you want to hear the interviews with other candidates, you can go to our website and listen to the Local Talk shows over the past 2 weeks. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you are listening to Local Talk.
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
That was The Galaxy Song by Monty Python from the movie The Meaning of Life. And that takes us to our next segment. On May 3rd, NASA launched InSight, a mission to explore Mars. My son-in-law, Kevin Gilligan, works for NASA and has been involved with this project over the past few years, so he attended the launch of the spacecraft. And my daughter, Abby Seiler, was able to accompany Kevin to the launch. InSight is short for Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy, and Heat Transport, and it is designed to study the crust, mantle, and core of Mars. I spoke with Kevin and Abby about the mission and about what it was like to be at the launch. I began by asking Kevin to explain his job at NASA.
Since October, I've been NASA's primary interface to the Government Accountability Office, which is Congress's oversight arm, to do a major programmatic audit on all of our major projects. But prior to that, for about 5 years, I was what's called a portfolio analyst in the Office of the Chief Financial Officer. My job was to become smart on the projects, go out to the contractor locations, work with the project teams to understand the project as best I can and the issues they struggle with and the resources they might need support from NASA headquarters. And then I would go and advocate for the project to the Chief Financial Officer and provide some different options for ways to solve challenges that are too big for just the project to solve on their own, leveraging resources from across the agency.
And that's how you were involved in this project, InSight.
Yeah.
And how many years ago did you start working on it?
The beginning of 2013 is when I started with this project.
And had the project been going on in advance, or is that about when it started?
It had been selected out of competition with other mission proposals, I think about a year prior to that. So by the time I started was right when we were, as an agency, as NASA, committing to a cost and schedule baseline and committing to this project through launch and operations. But it had a long life before I came on board.
So this spacecraft was sent to Mars. It's en route to Mars now. What is it supposed to do when it gets to Mars?
This mission is going to be peering into the interior of a terrestrial planet other than our own from an in-situ surface-based platform.
Say that again, what it is?
An in-situ surface-based platform.
In-situ surface-based platform. Okay, explain that.
So it's actually going to be taking measurements, direct measurements, and not doing remote sensing.
And what is it trying to learn or find out?
Spacecraft will approach Mars. It'll enter the atmosphere, land on the surface using propulsion and rocketry. When it gets to the surface, it'll take about 3 months. It'll use a robotic arm and actually place two primary instruments onto the surface of Mars, one being a seismology experiment and one being essentially a drill probe type thing that goes 16 feet down to the surface. And so the whole point of the project is to figure out what's inside Mars, what's it made of, what's the core, how hot is it, where the North Pole is actually on the planet, you know, the thermal state of the interior. It's also, I mean, it's so sensitive, it'll also be able to detect the rate of meteorite impacts all over the surface of Mars as well.
So instead of trying to understand and learn about this actual surface, which previous missions have done, this is trying to learn what's going on deep within the planet.
That's right. And it's actually kind of interesting because for every mission in the past that's landed on Mars, we've always tried to go to really interesting terrain, varied terrain, rocky, mountainous, valleys, all those things where water may have in the past sort of carved out the terrain and made it interesting. Whereas this one, the scientists wanted the most boring, flattest, nothing there place to land, because all he needs to do is park and be safe on the landing and put the stuff on the surface and just sit and listen.
And you were able to go to the launch both Abby and Kevin, you were both able to go. So tell us about that. Where was the launch site and what was it like?
So the launch took place about 2.5 hours up the coast from Los Angeles at the Vandenberg Air Force Base.
In California.
And that's in California. We headed out to L.A. and drove up, and there were a lot of people heading there just for this launch from around the world, really. It's an international project. So there were people there from France and Germany and England and all over the U.S. So the day before the launch, we gathered for a briefing and heard from the chief scientist and others involved in the launch system, the rocket.
The president of the European Space Agency.
Yes, the president of the French Space Agency, I think, spoke. So we got to hear from their point of view, you know, all that had gone into the mission. A lot of people in the room were family and friends of people who have worked on this mission for many years. So there were a lot of really excited and invested people. So it was great to hear directly from them about the mission, hear their excitement, and get us ready for the launch.
And the launch was then the next day.
Yes, it was the wee hours of the morning the next day.
Yeah, it was at 4:05 a.m., the launch. And, there was some time to get there, the buses get shipped out there. So we ended up waking up at 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah, 1:30, we woke up and met everyone else where the buses were taking a group of, I think there were about 1,500 of us in our group, to one of the somewhat closer viewing sites, a little closer than the general public one. And it dropped us all off, and we got ready for what we hoped would be an exciting launch.
And then what happened?
Well, you want to say, Kevin, how this was the first launch interplanetary from California?
It was the first interplanetary launch from the west coast of the United States. We've always launched from the Florida coast in the past, Mars missions. The reason being that our launch schedule is so tight right now, there's so many rockets going up in the east coast that we wanted to shift it to the west coast because we were able to, because the spacecraft was light enough in comparison to how strong the rocket was. So on the west coast in the morning, turns out that certain conditions created themselves where there was a very, very, very thick marine layer of fog.
Yeah, which I guess is pretty typical for the Central Californian coast. And a lot of people expected that the visibility would be low. But unfortunately, Mother Nature really was impressive that morning. And even from just 8 miles away from a massive rocket taking a spacecraft to another planet, we could not see one single ember or glow of light.
Wow.
What we did get to experience was the sound, still pretty cool. Fog couldn't block the sound. So we in the crowd heard the audio countdown of, you know, all the systems and checks and readiness. So we heard the countdown. We knew via the loudspeakers that it had gone off, and so we were waiting expectantly. Can't see anything, and I'm not sure how many seconds later. It was quite a delay, which shows you, it's just kind of cool to really experience how slowly sound
goes. Yeah, uh-huh.
Then we finally heard this big rumble, and you kind of feel it in your chest a little
rumble
bit.
/crackle.
Yeah, rumble/crackle is a good way to describe it.
Yeah, so we were about 8 miles away from the launch pad, and I was talking with the program executive just yesterday or the day before about his viewing of it through the fog, because he was only about 2.5 to 3 miles away from the launch pad, and he had the very same experience we did, where he could not even see it.
Could not see it.
Not even a glow from less than 3 miles away.
Did it shake the ground or anything like that?
Not visibly, but you can feel that, like, something big is happening. It's much louder than, you know, any sound that you'd be accustomed mm-hmm. to, and like a deeper sound, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of sense it. It's maybe not going to, like, hurt your ears loud, but you'd be like, oh, that's something big happening.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw the final space shuttle launch back in 2011, I was 3 miles away. That was a much more powerful rocket. And, you know, I could feel it in my chest, you know, through the whole body. So these things definitely do shake you. This one was a slightly smaller rocket from farther away, but you could still feel the power of it.
And it was a smaller rocket, even though it's going farther than the rocket that carried the space shuttle. because the thing that it's carrying was lighter? Is that why this could be a smaller rocket, even though it's going farther?
Yeah, the spacecraft had less mass than a typical interplanetary spacecraft does, and it was just a smaller spacecraft, and NASA tried to maximize the value we get for the dollar that we pay for launch vehicle services, and so we got the absolute smallest rocket that we could for what we needed to launch up there to conduct the science we were seeking.
Even though you couldn't see it, it was still a pretty impressive moment to be a part of, I imagine.
Well, for me, it definitely was. Even though I couldn't see it, I was so happy because, you know, seeing and knowing the project team that put their hearts and souls into the project for years and years and had so many struggles too, technical challenges to overcome, to know that all their efforts culminated in a launch successfully was just really cool to see happen.
And that
to hear happen, I guess.
And that you played a role in that too.
I did play a role. Albeit I tend to see it as somewhat of a small contribution, a very small relative contribution to the actual project.
And Abby, what was it like for you to be there?
Well, it was my first rocket launch, so I think it was still very impressive to me. I don't have anything to compare it to. And I'd be excited to go to another one and hopefully be able to
without the fog.
See it go up. But yeah, I think the excitement was palpable, and people were really proud of the achievement. And I think it's always a relief when it goes off without a hitch. And I just think it's pretty cool that the scientists and engineers and everyone involved with the launch, I don't think they were bothered by the fog at all. You know, I think winds can be an issue, but you know, they're basing everything on mass. Like, they don't need to see the rocket.
Yeah,
you know, everything
is
just based on really precise calculations and years of preparedness and thinking through every scenario. And it's all so well planned out that, you know, they don't even need to see it. They know what it's going to do.
They primarily relied on infrared cameras to watch the rocket.
That's an interesting way to think about it. So it's on its way to Mars. And when will it reach the planet?
Cyber Monday.
So that's what, like six months away?
November 26th.
And does your involvement with the project continue, or are you pretty much on to other things now that it's been launched?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have a portfolio of projects. We have many other projects that are ready to launch. We have another one launching in a week and a half. We have four other science missions launching this year out into the solar system, and we have many more projects coming online now earlier in their formulation phases where they're doing the planning and design. And so my job is to look across all of those science missions as well as our human exploration missions, our aeronautics projects, and our space technology development efforts. So I have to look across everything that NASA does. So I will be watching InSight very closely as it cruises to Mars 66 million miles. And I'll be watching really closely when it lands successfully, I hope. And then my favorite part is to see the science that eventually comes back from these things. The data comes back and gets sold out to all the universities around the world that want it. It's free data for everybody as a public agency. And then you get to see these amazing findings at the end of the day, which is what it's all about.
So that's how it works, that because NASA is a public agency, they're perfectly willing to share all the data that they get.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, is there another project right now that you're working on that's particularly interesting you could tell us about?
Hard to choose. We have the James Webb Space Telescope, which is one of our flagship missions. It's been in development for many, many years. It's one that has faced many technological hurdles over the years because it is so many new and advanced technologies. It's just things that have never been done before. It'll be the biggest space telescope in history. It's basically the Hubble's successor, and it will be situated about a million miles from Earth, which is about three times farther than the moon. It has a massive sun shield to keep it dark and cold, and it'll peer back to the very beginning of the universe itself and bring us back some amazing data and findings and just knowledge about the universe we live in.
That sounds pretty impressive. And when is that due to be launched?
It'll be launched no earlier than May 2020, so about 2 years from now. I just want to throw a plug in. So for anyone traveling to Florida, Orlando, or Disney World or something, make sure you check, go on to NASA.gov and look for the launch manifest for Kennedy Space Center, because anyone in the public can go watch launches from the area, and there's lots of them these days.
Oh, so if you're just in the area, you can. You have to apply to be able to attend, but they let just public people in.
You don't have to apply. Just drive to the nearest public viewing location, and there's all sorts of information on the website to help out.
And it's been fun learning about space as just an observer and along for the ride for these things.
So you feel lucky that you were able to go and be there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's... you know, something I would have maybe caught a passing headline about, you know, or maybe read a little bit about the general goal of the mission. But, you know, to understand the complexity and all the different people that worked on the project and to watch Kevin keeping track of the mission for this many years, I feel like I know it pretty well. So it was exciting.
Thank you for sharing that exciting experience with us.
Happy to do so. Anytime. I love talking about space.
That was Abby Seiler, my daughter, and her husband, Kevin Gilligan, who works in the office of the Chief Financial Officer at NASA and has been involved with the InSight mission for the past 5 years. I asked him why the launch had to be at that particular time, 4:05 a.m., and Kevin explained that it was because of the relative position of Earth and Mars combined with the rotation of the Earth. Scientists hope that this mission will provide information about the early formation of the rocky planets in our solar system, that is, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, more than 4 billion years ago, as well as rocky exoplanets. Thanks to both of them for sharing their experience with us. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you are listening to Local Talk. I'm your host, Gail Seiler. The Main Street Farmers Market has become a much-anticipated fixture of summer in Ames. It runs from May to October and seems to be getting bigger and better each day. Logene Peterson, who is the manager of the Farmers Market, is here to talk with us today. And also with her is Daryl Civils, an intern of the Chamber of Commerce who's working on the Farmers Market, and Jessica Kerpika, one of the vendors. She's from Heritage Hill Farms. Thank you all for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're
welcome.
Mm-hmm. Logene, let's start with you. Can you give us a little bit of the background or history of the farmers market?
Well, the market started in 2011. This will be our eighth season downtown on Main Street. And we were started by the Main Street Cultural District to bring something down to the Main Street area to add to the excitement of Main Street. And we started out with approximately 24 occasional and full-time vendors. And last year we had 119. And this year we have gained 17 new vendors. So we have definitely grown and become a pop-up community every Saturday morning down at the market. So it's a lot of fun.
It's definitely something that people look forward to this mm-hmm. season. Can you give us an idea of what some of the vendors are, either people that have been there a long time or maybe some new ones this year?
We have a lot of local vendors who have been there for a long time. Some of the new ones we have a Jiminy Crickets who brings crickets to the market. They're flavored and roasted. We have...
And those are produced locally?
Yes, they are, here in Ames. Mm-hmm. Okay. They raise them themselves.
How are they selling?
Good. Yeah. They're very busy every time I walk by. And they make things, and then they grind them up also and make it into flour that they make cookies and bars and things like that with. So it's a very new thing. It's high in protein. We also have Two Rivers Bread that has joined us, a couple produce vendors, and, you know, just a wide variety. Jewelry vendors. It's a nice variety that has joined us.
Quite a mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And Daryl, you're working to get vendors involved. Is that right?
Yes, just more so helping maybe locate new vendors throughout the community. I know Logene has a good array of vendors now, and they're very trustworthy coming back next year. I just think that I can bring or help her locate just new vendors who maybe don't even know about the market. I go to Iowa State, and a lot of people don't know, I guess students don't know about the market, especially during the summertime when everybody leaves and comes back. I've been living here for a while, so I understand the community, and I've seen the farmer's market, but only been going the last 2 years. So I see what's on campus, and I can feel that I can, in ways, help her bring new people in to enjoy and also work with us. So I'm just interning, being the bird out there to help her bring people in for sure. Yeah,
yeah, and strengthen that connection mm-hmm, mm-hmm. between ISU, especially the students, and the market,
mm-hmm,
the
yes.
Ames Farmers Market. And we have one of our vendors here with us, Jessica Kerpika. Tell us about who you are and the stand that you provide.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm a part of Heritage Hill Farm. We started in 2012, and our main focus is a lot of heirloom and open pollinated varieties. So we're growing like the interesting things that people are not going to be seeing in the grocery stores and whatnot. And it's also local, so it means that it comes from our farm, which is located just south of town by the Ames Airport, to the farmer's market, which is a really short distance. We also grow for some other restaurants as well as grocery stores, and have participated in other markets such as Des Moines and some more other, you know, local ones. But we really like the Ames Market because it's a big event where you can count on usually the same people coming by every week. We have our regulars, mm-hmm. and people really look forward to, you know, picking out and asking the farmers what's new, what's on the horizon, how can you cook with this, what's your favorite way. And a lot of times our regulars come back and report back and let you know how things were, or wondering if you have more of this, or wondering when this is in season. So it's a great aspect to have that local connection to a lot of the other vendors such as myself, and also the vendor community. There's a lot of really other great producers out there that we're friends with that we look forward to seeing every Saturday.
And how many years have you been doing it?
We've been doing the Ames Market for probably about four or so. We didn't start out with it right away. We're just trying to still regain our footing from something new. And so we took a year and kind of saw what grew well on our land. And then the following year came and started vending at the Ames Farmers Market. So it's been a really great experience.
And can you tell us about one thing that's selling well this year or is new that you're producing this year?
So this year's been a little tricky because of our snowstorms in April, kind of condensed our window to get everything done. So instead of having a nice, well-spaced, you know, we're planting this week, we're doing this the following week, everything's jammed together. So it's been a little bit of a scramble and a hustle. But what I'm really looking forward to this summer are the heirloom tomatoes that we grow. We have grow over 60 varieties, all shapes, colors, the diversity, the flavors, everything. It's my favorite crop. So I'm ready for summer tomatoes.
Okay.
So wait a little bit, but
yeah,
pretty soon.
Yeah. So people can look for Heritage Tomatoes at the Heritage Hill Farms stand.
Yes.
Or stall. And Daryl, tell us how people can sign up to be vendors, or what if someone's thinking they might want to do it?
Sure, yeah. Well, we can go to the Ames Farmers Market's website at amesmainstreetfarmersmarket.com, and there will be a vendors tab. And on the left side, on the left-hand side of that vendors tab will be become a vendor, and then it'll be a PDF file that opens up, and it'll tell you all the rules and regulations, and then it'll give you options to describe your vendor choice. And so, mm-hmm. yep. And then you can also, if you want to view some of what we do, you can go to our Instagram and Twitter page, and that'll just be Ames Farmers Market, both Twitter and Instagram, and the Facebook too as well.
Okay. So you're bringing social media to the farmers market.
Yes,
now.
Yes. Trying to bring that that feeling of community to the social media. Like I said, I feel that we can still market out to our community, and I feel like our young people just don't know enough about it. So I just want to make the Instagram and Twitter, you know, very lively, very community, because it's a special place here in Ames, and I think people should really come to the Ames Farmers Market just to see how our community is, for sure. So,
And there's also usually entertainment there in the mornings. Tell us about that.
We have a wide variety of genres that our musicians bring down to the market and make our market seem festive every week. We have two of them every week. And along with that, we have special events that you can check out on our website. But like this coming week, we will have a free petting zoo for the children and the families to bring their children down to. And we have different events during the season. And one of the new events that we're going to have later on in August will be our farm-to-table supper, where Aunt Maud's is going to be our chef and help us cook up a fabulous meal from using all the ingredients from our market, or as much as we can anyway. So we're really looking forward to that. And that will be on the street out in front of Aunt Maud's. So,
and when will that be?
That will be August 12th. And we'll be getting more information about that soon.
So at the end of this... Towards the end of the summer, so there should be lots of good produce.
Yes, that will be a time when there's a lot of variety we can choose from and add to the supper.
And can people also apply to be musicians or play, or has that all been determined so far?
Well, this year we are full, but it would be a good idea to contact us this year to get on our list. We ask the musicians in January to sign up. And usually our places are signed up within a week or two. So it's a very popular that people love to come. So
people
a short time frame. That.
So if people want to do it next year, they need to get on that in
January. Let us know so we can send them the information out in January.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a need for volunteers who can help out at the farmers market?
Yes, we'd love to have volunteers just to help set up take down, help us with the cooking contest that we have and the other events. We'd love to have volunteers just come, just mingle and visit with everybody.
And if people are interested in volunteering, they can find that on your website?
Yes. Yes. We have a page on our website that talks about volunteers and what the different things you could do to volunteer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And, Jessica, what you must have to get up really early in the morning to get there and get set up. What's the Saturday morning like for you?
Our Saturday morning routine is a little bit better than it used to be. I would also do Des Moines Market, and I'd be up usually by 3:30 or 4 a.m. for that to get set up for all of that. It starts
so
at 7.
So you would have people going to both locations.
Yes. But for Ames, it's a little more friendly. We're usually up by about 5:30 or so. Everything's done the night before. As far as packing and hopefully getting everything as ready as possible. And then we wake up and head to market and bring along. My husband also helps with setup, and two little boys tag along, and they go back for nap time and come back a little bit later. So it's a family affair, definitely.
That's nice. Yeah, you see lots of kids both wandering and enjoying the market, but also helping their parents out in the various stands. Tell us again what the day and times and locations are for people who may not know.
Yeah, so every Saturday at 8 a.m., we'll ring the bell, open the market, and 12:30 when it ends. If you'd like to sign up, once again, it's amesfarmersmarket.com. And then we're on our Twitter and Instagram. It's just Ames Farmers Market every Saturday, 8 to 12.
Do you have any idea of how many people come on an average Saturday?
Well, we have counted.
To try to get an idea.
And we average probably around 2,500.
That's impressive.
Give or take. Yes.
If the weather's good. And any other particular new vendors that you want to mention this year?
Oh, there's so many. Grandview Beef, Sweetery 2 is a new one. We have jewelry vendors, food vendors, just a wide variety.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for being here. I've been speaking with LaJean Peterson, Daryl Civils, and Jessica Kerpika about the Main Street Farmers Market in Ames. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And we also heard The Galaxy Song by Monty Python. Thanks to Cal Halliburton for his interview of Ross Wilburn. And remember that you can find all of the gubernatorial candidate interviews on the KHOI website. Thanks also to Abby Seiler and Kevin Gilligan for telling us about the NASA launch that they attended. KHOI recently wrapped up our membership drive, but it is not too late to become a member. You can do it online at khoifm.org. Just look for the donate button, or you can call 515-292-2878. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. That's workinames.com.